beautiful self-published collections of poetry. If you are interested in that, you should ask him. They're very beautiful. And you are a spiritual director, of course, retreat giver, but you're also working on one of your books. I mean, you have already quite some books. You either have been collaborated or they are yours. But now this book you are writing on in these years is on Denise Levertov, which is a poet. But the interesting thing is Kevin is not interested, and he's going to talk much more eloquently about that than I do. Not so much interested in the English literature part of Denise Levertov, although of course that's always going to be an aspect of it, but about her journey and faith and her language and faith. And you have found an incredible inspiration for this evening in bridging that with the language Pope Francis is using and the vision Pope Francis is proposing us for faith. And so it is really a great privilege for me. Kevin now is actually in Denver, not anywhere around here. And he's the vice president for mission at Regis University there. And it is a great pleasure that we have him kind of on the hook for tonight, for which I would like to say he let down a dinner with great honoring and honorific moments for him and his service he has given to another university. And he, in a good Jesuit manner, left all that to serve all us with his wisdom. So Kevin, I can't give you thank enough that you left that for being here with us humble citizens of the kingdom, and that you really want to share with us something wonderful about Pope Francis and the poet you have loved since many, many years.
Thank you.
A really fun introduction. So it's great to be back here. I spent a summer at St. Agnes about 6 or 7 years ago, part of a time so that I was helping out in the parish and getting to know people, getting to know this spiritual life center. It's really neat to be back. As Julia said, I've been reading Denise Levertov, and she has for more than 2 decades now, 2.5 decades, has become an integral part of my prayer life and integral part of my teaching, my way of being in the world. She's really one of those figures, you know, and I can think of several theologians like that and several other maybe writers, but who just has been super formative in my own journey. And so I've become really interested in her journey. So I'll say a little bit about her, but I thought I'd like to begin because I really would like to start with some images and with some music. And I want to think about this as almost like an opening prayer, but a prayer really of contemplation, not so much. The words will be a poem of Denise's that appear on the slides, if you can see them. I could also read them while we're listening to music and watching the images. So I want to just begin with this, and then I'll kind of say a little bit about this reflection. Okay. A gift. Just when you seem to yourself nothing but a flimsy web of questions, you are given the questions of others to hold in the emptiness of your hands. Songbird eggs that can still hatch if you keep them warm. Butterflies opening and closing themselves in your cupped palms. Trusting you not to injure their scintillant fur, their dust. You are given the questions of others as if they were answers to all you ask. Yes, perhaps this gift is your answer. So I hope you noticed that the photographer of those wildflowers was Sister Julia. And those flowers are in a place that I've been in my whole life, and I never saw them until she started taking photos. And I'm really struck by the way art, whether photography or painting, whether poetry or novel writing, dance or music, I'm so struck by the way art teaches us how to see in a new way, teaches us how to listen, how to attend, how to experience life. And I just don't think we can say enough about the arts and their way of training us, of teaching us to pay attention. So Denise Levertov, as a small child, she began to think for herself as, I have an artist's destiny. She said that at least by the age of 10, probably earlier, she was convinced that she was special, that she was an artist, and she had a destiny as an artist. And by 16, she was pretty frustrated with ballet lessons. She didn't have the right, as she would say, for her dance was something to enjoy and watch, not to do. Actually, she was very graceful. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine told me that when he presented her with the martini at his home, completely full martini glass, she did a 360 pirouette and bowed and didn't spill a drop. But Denise, she published her first poem when she was 16. She was born in 1923. And she died about 25 years ago. She was born nearly 100 years ago, died about 25 years ago in December, right before Christmas of 1997. She lived most of her life in the United States, although she was born in a suburb of what is now Greater London, then was more rural. in the Essex area of London. And she grew up with some wilderness nearby. And from the time she was little, she just fell in love with nature, with the countryside, with the English countryside. She never stops being English, you know, but she moved to America after she married an American GI at the end of the Second World War. They lived for a time in the continent and then were married in London and then eventually came to New York City. They did live for, I had about a 2-year interlude in Mexico. She was fluent in Spanish. She was fluent in a number of languages, actually. But she became, in those years, the 1940s and 50s, an American poet. She, as she actually says at one point, she relearned the cadences of the English language. Mm-hmm. In an American,
if you tie the knot,
in an American,
lose your health coverage when you get back home, or welcome someone new to the family. Cover California helps you get health insurance and life changes.
Just turn down your sound all the way.
Learn more at coverca.com.
That's the problem with using YouTube. It's my fault. It eventually goes to an ad. So Denise, I wanted to say a couple things about her, because it's helpful to kind of see this journey she was on. She grew up in a very religious family. So her father, you kind of pick up a hint of this in her last name. Her father was a Hasidic Jew from Belarus who read the Gospel of Matthew in Hebrew as a college student and found the Messiah, which didn't please his family. Although he wasn't completely excommunicated or anything, but he became a Christian, very, very fervent, passionate Christian, took the name Paul, actually Paul Philip Levertov, and because of the Apostle Paul, who found the Messiah, and he thought of himself all his life as a Jew, as a faithful Jew who had found the Messiah. Other Jews find that a troubling category. They're not completely clear with that. But the year before Denise was born, 1923, he was ordained an Anglican priest. So he had a little tiny parish for Jewish converts to Christianity. And he was a brilliant scholar, and he was translating the Zohar, Kabbalah, all of these mystical texts of Judaism into English. He's actually a great scholar. So Denise tells stories about how he would come down for lunch. She would come in from playing outside, and lunchtime would be her dad telling these mystical stories from the Kabbalah about, you know, the two rabbis walking along the road and suddenly an angel appears to them and they think it's another rabbi and they're having this conversation. And it sounds just like the road to Emmaus. You know, Denise, her childhood was full of these stories. It was full of the King James Version of the Bible, and it was full of the Anglican liturgy. But by the time, so she's coming of age as a teenager, a young adult, during the Second World War. She's a nurse's aide during the bombings of London. She saw a lot, you know, and in some ways, the way she tells it, she had this growing vague uncomfortableness, awkwardness, embarrassment at her parents' religion and religiosity and religion in general. So that by the time she was in her, say, mid-20s, she was no longer connected to church. She was always vaguely uncomfortable with that vis-a-vis her parents. She was married. When she married a guy who was more or less an unchurched Jewish American. So it's a very interesting journey. And for the next 3 decades, I mean, this woman is writing poetry that's filled with images from scripture, the language of spirituality. I mean, it's just really interesting, even in these earlier years, when she thought of herself as an agnostic, a kind of a syncretist, borrowing from wherever she could borrow to try to put together things. And through many years, she's publishing books of poetry. She ended up publishing 19 distinct original books of poetry. Some poems show up in more than one collection, but for the most part of new poems. And then there's collections and collections. And there's finally the collected poems that I can't bring it tonight, but it would be about as big as this book in one volume. I mean, it's a huge thick volume because she published 1,000 poems. So she was very prolific. But here's what's interesting. She's going through the 50s and 60s, just writing great stuff. One of the first women poets to really be recognized by the men as first rate. And one of the men who really just saw her brilliance was William Carlos Williams. And he was the one, and they developed a very good friendship. Their letters are published. And another younger poet, around her own age, Robert Duncan. And that's a very interesting story because they were friends for about 20 years and their friendship really shattered around their very different ways of opposing the Vietnam War. Denise became very politically active and she started writing political poetry in the late 60s. And that's itself a fascinating story. And you see her wrestling with new forms, new ways of writing poetry. She's losing some of her readers. She's pissing people off, including Duncan. But she has this integrity. I really think that this is something I admire, is that she just felt called to do this. This was true. And she would even say later, looking back, some of those poems weren't great poems, but the need to write those poems, I cannot shake. But what's interesting to me is it's in the 70s. So the Vietnam War rattles to an unseemly close, right? We've got Vietnam and Watergate. Vietnam ending, Watergate, all this stuff going on. Several things happen in her own life. Her marriage of 25 or so years also kind of just came to an end. There was no life left in it. She couldn't reach her husband. Just basically the way she would put it. They remained friends. They remained friendly. He remained on her insurance the rest of his life. But because she was the breadwinner in the family. Giving lectures, teaching at Stanford and a number of other places. She eventually sold her papers to Stanford, and that enabled her to live, somewhat comfortably, moved to Seattle at the end of her life. But in those years, so her marriage ended, and in about 3 years later, her mother died at the age of 93 down in Mexico. Her father died years before in the 50s. Her mother had moved to Mexico. Denise visited her often, had a very close relationship with her. She has some beautiful poems about her mother's illness. She has a poem called The Daughter. Actually, she has two poems, The Daughter 1 and The Daughter 2, where she's wrestling with, was I there enough? Was I a good enough daughter? I mean, you just see this honesty in her poetry. And there's an autobiographical feature, but she's never focused on herself. It's not confessional poetry. She's very clear on that. It's that she wants to write about the human reality, our human reality, and what happened. So she was at a concert one night. She loved classical music. Absolutely. She loved art museums and classical music, two of the things she deeply loved. She'd been to a concert where the concert was set up as all these different parts of the mass. But from different eras, different composers. And she thought, is this going to work? Baroque, classical, neoclassical, all these different. And it worked. And she was sort of blown away by what a beautiful concert was. And she asked herself, what gave the concert unity? And she wondered, was it the mass? Was it the form, the genre? And she says, can a poet write a mass? So she set out to write a secular mass. And then later, in one of the later drafts, it's an agnostic mass. And it finally gets published as, get this, Mass for the Day of St. Thomas Didymus.
Yes.
Doubting Thomas. Writing the mass, she wrote herself back into faith. And she started going to church again. and for a number of years was church hopping with different friends. She had a couple good friends down at Santa Clara and at Stanford. She was friends with Al and Barbara Jelke, who are professors, retired professors at Stanford. I've become friends with them these later years. So she's moving around, going to different places. And about the time she moves to Seattle, she's saying, you know, there's something a little unseemly about this church hopping. I really ought to commit somewhere. And where she ended up committing was the Jesuit parish in Seattle.
Wow.
And she became a Catholic in the last 7 or 8 years of her life. And all during those late 70s, all through the 80s, till her death in 97, there's some absolutely stunning religious poetry. I would say the best religious poetry in the English language of the last 100 years. And that includes Mary Oliver, that includes Billy Collins, that includes some great poets. But Denise is just on a different level, in my humble opinion. I just am astonished at her way of trying to open up the human story. And so that's what brings me to want to reflect with you on a couple of her poems. What's hard about a talk like this is I'm going to read poetry, and I'm not going to give you the words like I did in the video. I want you to hear it. Not everything will come through all at once. I do think her poetry has this great quality that you can actually understand it. She writes more or less in English sentences, even though she'll break up the lines on the page the way a musical composer would score the music. She sees line breaks and pauses and things as ways of scoring the poem read aloud. So let me do this in just four brief pieces. I want to start with what I want to call an effort at articulating a mysticism of the beautiful. So I said to Julia that my idea for this talk was to call it Beauty Ever Ancient, Ever New, : The Poetry of Denise Levertov and the Vision of Pope Francis. The vision of Pope Francis is going to be pretty implicit. I'm going to come to it at the end. I'm going to say a few things about what I see going on in this crucial papacy. But so beauty, ever ancient, ever new. How many of you recognize those words? Just about everybody. Even if you don't think you do, you do. It comes from St. Augustine and from one of the major passages of his great book, The Confessions. So let me read St. Augustine. He writes, "Late have I loved you, O beauty, ever ancient, ever new. Late have I loved you. You were within me, but I was outside. And it was there I searched for you. In my unlovingness, I plunged into the lovely things which you created. You were with me, but I was not with you. Created things kept me from you. Yet if they had not been in you, they would not have been at all. You called, you shouted, and you broke through my deafness. You flashed, you shone, and you dispelled my blindness. You breathed your fragrance on me. I drew in breath, and now I pant for you. I have tasted you, now I hunger and thirst for more. You touched me, and I burned for your peace." Isn't that great? That's St. Augustine. Sometimes we throw him under the bus, but he's really a mystic and a great one. So beauty ever ancient, ever new is a name for God. Augustine is calling on God. This is a prayer. He's addressing God as beauty ever ancient, ever new, which in a sense indicates that beauty functions as a doorway into or a bridge across to the divine. But we can get caught in the thing and miss the beautiful. This is what St. Augustine is saying. There's so much to say about this. The image of sight and blindness, the image of light. So we often associate beauty with light, sunsets, or gorgeous flowers photographed in the daytime, like those photos we just saw. But listen to these lines from a poem Denise calls Hymns to Darkness. She has three little hymns within this longer poem. I'm just going to read the first one. Beauty growls from the fertile dark. Don't disturb the glow. Shadows are not contrivances devised for your confusion. They grow in subtle simplicity from the root, silence. And words put forth before there's time to hesitate about their strangeness are swaying bridges, quick, near across, to further dark illumination. Lovely tarnish of old silver, bronze, long buried. Now that is not an easy poem. That is a really rich set of images, powerful images. But what she seems to be getting at, and I'm finding myself just going back to this poem and kind of, as it were, drink it in, take it in. Beauty growls from the fertile dark, and it emerges from silence. Its root is silence. And the need for attention, the need to pay attention. And then there's this sense that beauty, which is almost always new, is very ancient. See how it shares in that quality of God. That's one of the things that I just find so touching. But there's another piece, and this takes me to my second poem. So I start with the mysticism of beauty, or of the beautiful. I want to talk about beauty and protest. If you notice, Augustine's praise of beauty has nothing to do with romantic infatuation. It is not a romantic kind of sense of beauty. And it's not an undialectical sense of beauty, if I could put it sort of negatively. Rather, there appears in Augustine's very words a prophetic element, an element of protest, if you will, a protest of his own selfishness, of his own blindness, his own deafness, his own confusing the things with the beautiful. And so it's his own inability to really be present to God. He's actually protesting that. He's confessing, mm-hmm. right? The confessions, he's laying it out there. I was missing the point, and yet God was faithful. God was faithful. God was faithful. Denise never stopped being political. After the Vietnam War had ended, she was paying attention to other things. There's amazing poems from El Salvador. There's poems about Saint Romero. There's poems she wrote the words, the lyrics to a long oratorio on the martyrs of El Salvador. Beautiful stuff. She was writing poems protesting the degradation of the earth in the 1970s. Rachel Carson was one of her heroes, and she was using her poetry to try to talk about what are we doing? What are we doing? Some of those poems are quite strong. So in one of her last collections, it was actually the final collection she published, Still Alive, the year before she died, is called Sands of the Well. So the gift, a gift, which I started with, is from that book. This, the poem I read just a moment ago, Hymns to Darkness, is from that book. This poem is also from that book. She calls this protesting at the nuclear test site. A year before, this desert had raised its claws to me, importunate and indifferent, half naked beggar, displaying sores at the city gates. Now again, in the raw glare of Lent, spikes, thorns, spines. Where is the beauty others perceived? I could not. But when the Shoshone elders spoke, last year and now once more, slowly I began to see what I saw as ugly remarks of torture. When he was young, this was desert too, but of a different aspect, austere but joyful. A people's reverence illumined the stony ground. Now, as my mind knew, but my imagination strained to acknowledge, deep, deep and narrow, the holes were bored into the land's innards, and there, in savage routine, Hiroshima blasts exploded, rape repeated month after month for years. What repelled me here was no common aridity. Unappealing to lovers of lakes and trees, but anguish, lineaments drab with anguish. This terrain turned to the human world a gaze of scorn, victim to tormentor. Slowly, revulsion unstiffened itself. I learned almost to love the dry and hostile earth, its dusty growth of low, harsh plants, sparse in unceasing wind, could almost have bent to kiss that leper's face. Suffering, especially the suffering of victims, is beauty under the sign of its negation. I'm quoting my dear friend, Bill O'Neill, that Jesuit who's over in a refugee camp in Kenya as we speak this evening. He's been there since before the pandemic, serving as one of only a handful of priests in a refugee camp of 185,000 people. Kakuma. And Bill says beauty, you know, suffering is beauty under the sign of its negation, especially the suffering of victimization, the disfiguring suffering that causes a person to be bent all their life, and the earth also a victim. So if we love beauty, we have to face the violence and protest. If we love the earth, if we love the sunrises, if we love the forests and the waters, then we have to be alarmed. I'll tell you what I think we need is we need to learn how to pray in a new way in the face of global climate change. It puts all of us in a situation of utter poverty because we, with all of our connections and our gifts, our intelligence, whatever we have, we can't fix it. And it's so complicated. It's political, it's cultural, it's economic, it's woven into the sin of the world, and it's breaking our planet. And it takes us to a new place of imagining how to speak to God. So I want to move from protest to liturgy. And I want to read another poem from the same collection that Denise writes. And it sounds almost like the one I just read, but it's different. This one is called Don Helder Camera at the Nuclear Test Site. She was there with him. They were both arrested in Nevada. And do most of you know who Don Helder was? Don Helder Camara was a bishop in Brazil. He was born in 1909, so he's 15 or 16 years older than Denise, 14 years older, you know, kind of half generation older. He was a priest in Brazil, became a bishop in 1952. auxiliary bishop of Rio, and then was made the bishop by Paul VI of an area of northeastern Brazil, rainforest being destroyed, indigenous people being killed. And he was the bishop there all the way up until his retirement in 1985. And he was outspoken. He was one of the great liberation bishops. He was one of the bishops who had a huge influence on Gaudium et Spes, the pastoral constitution of the church in the modern world, of Vatican II. And Dom Helder's cause for canonization as a saint has begun under Pope Francis, under his own local bishop, the bishop there in Brazil, and Pope Francis in Rome. And there are some things to be said about that on right-wing Catholic blogs, because they don't like Dom Helder. He's an absolutely beautiful human being, an amazing human being. So if you take away anything from tonight, go Google Dom Helder and read a little bit about him and read some of his things. Here's Denise's poem, Dom Helder Camera at the Nuclear Test Site. Dom Helder, octogenarian wisp of human substance, arrived from Brazil, raises his arm and gazes toward a sky pallid with heat to implore peace, and then waves a goodbye for now to God as to a compadre. The mass is over, go in peace, to love and serve the Lord. He walks down with the rest of us to cross the cattle grid, entering forbidden ground where marshals wait with their handcuffs. After hours of waiting, pinned into two wire-fenced enclosures, some climbing to cloudless zenith, till everyone has been processed, booked, released to trudge one by one up the slope to the boundary line, back to a freedom that's not so free. We're all reassembled. We form two circles, one contained in the other, to dance clockwise and counterclockwise. Like children in Duncan's vision, but not to the song of ashes, of falling, we dance in the unity that brought us here. Instinct pulls us into the ancient rotation, symbol of continuance, light and persistent as a tumbleweed, but not adrift. Dom Helder, too, faithful pilgrim, dances at the turning core. Would you have loved to have been there at that liturgy? How important it is to be able to pray our anguish and our love of the beautiful, the land, the people. And it's something we learn. It's something that goes on throughout our life. And this is why I find Denise so marvelous. I mean, she was learning. And learning. And she was different at different stages of her life. In that late religious stage, still political, still ecstatic with the world's beauty, but now deeply in love with the source of that beauty, with the creator of that beauty. I've written several times, I actually gave a talk at a conference on Denise Levertov back in 2015. I was one of the keynote speakers at a conference dedicated to her at Loyola University Chicago. And I said at that time, and I've published this in a couple of places, that I talked about Denise Levertov's lifelong journey of faith, recognizing, of course, that that can sound very strange when you consider that for three decades she was an agnostic. And I think the faith journey is old. I'm convinced of that. So part of the reason it can seem so strange is that troublesome word, faith, right? In our contemporary US public discourse, typically we see faith as an adherence to a set of particular beliefs. So we conflate faith with a set of ideas, teachings, laws, or adages that cannot be established on the basis of philosophical or scientific reason, but only accepted on the basis of some authority. Right? And so faith suddenly looks very arbitrary. To make things even more problematic, we tend to see faith as utterly private, with no legitimate weight in the public sphere, because it can't be established in the ways that other kind of argumentation can. These typical images of faith might contain grains of truth, I think they do, but they often serve ideologies by reducing faith to its most immature and most unironic manifestations. They share more in common with the species of fanatical fervor than a grounded encounter with divine reality. Let me give you an example of that dense paragraph. I saw a bumper sticker once in my home state of Wyoming on a great big pickup truck. And it said, "The Bible said it, and I believe it, and that settles it." And I thought, I'm really glad I didn't grow up in that pickup truck. The arbitrariness, and that gets taken as being fake. And we think that's strong faith. William Lynch, this great Jesuit intellectual of the last century, he likes to say that quote unquote strong faith is the strong faith of a two-year-old that knows two principal words, me and no. You know, that's the strong faith of a two-year-old. And faith has to go through stages, has to be shaken up. This is the irony of faith. As we move through our life, the two-year-old realizes he's not the center of the universe, but he is loved. And his mother, who says no, still cares for him. That doesn't make sense to that two-year-old brain. But at 4 or 5, makes a lot more sense. At 25 or 45, you just kind of find yourself giving thanks for those people that raise you with all their flaws. So here's where Denise comes in for me. I think this part of her enormous achievement as a poet comes from what I call her grounded encounters with reality, including divine reality. As that begins to dawn on her life, it still remains so grounded. You see, I think true faith in God cannot grow to maturity if it's not rooted in what Lynch would call a horizontal faith. The faith is, first of all, trust. And if we can't trust each other, how are we going to trust transcendence? And if trust gets broken, boy, oh boy, a human person is deeply damaged. It makes it very hard to ever love. So what Denise is doing is showing us what this looks like to take this very grounded sense of faith. And I want to end with two short poems, one from that same volume, Sands of the Well, and the other written a little bit earlier from a book she called Oblique Prayers. And so I want to read these two poems. That you'll notice some similarities in the images and also some differences. But this is Denise, I think, doing theology at a very profound level. So the first poem is called Suspended. I had grasped God's garment in the void, but my hand slipped on the rich silk of it. The everlasting arms my sister loved to remember must have upheld my leaden weight from falling, even so. For though I claw at empty air and feel nothing, no embrace, I have not flown. Now let me read a poem she wrote a few years before that one called The Avowal. As swimmers dare to lie face to the sky, and water bears them. As hawks rest upon air, and air sustains them, so would I learn to attain free fall and float into Creator Spirit's deep embrace, knowing no effort earns that all surrounding grace. Isn't that great? Let me read that again. I just think this is an astounding poem. As swimmers dare to lie face to the sky and water bears them, as hawks rest upon air and air sustains them, so would I learn to attain free fall and float into Creator Spirit's deep embrace, knowing no effort earns that all surrounding grace. She's a Mozart with language. I really think with the English language, she's like a Mozart. So here's where I want to bring in Pope Francis. I want to think about his vision of the church. I read a book about 20 years ago by a French Benedictine named Ghislain Lafont. I was actually asked to review it for America Magazine. And so I read it very carefully. It's a fairly sophisticated book of ecclesiology, thinking about the church. And Lafont, as a good Benedictine, writes and thinks in centuries. So he's not thinking about this issue or that issue of the day, all the things that vex us, all the things we're talking about in our synod conversations. He's thinking in big, he's thinking in eons. And he's looking at the church of the early, the first millennium, and watching it evolve into a church centered around monasteries and places of prayer and learning and work and hospitality. And as the Middle Ages, the early Middle Ages, begin to move into the church's second decade, you have the rise of what Lafont calls a monarchical church, a church modeled on the political order of the day, just as in a certain sense, the earlier was modeled on the political order of the day. I saw several of you shaking your heads like, oh, I hate that damn monarchical church. But the thing is, there's a lot of greatness in it, a lot of greatness. And sometimes standing in, say, the cathedral at Chartres and outside of Paris in France, or, you know, looking at some of the great art that was produced in the Highland Regions, our breath can be taken away. You know, there really is greatness there. But that age is over. And we're in a third millennium. And Lafont calls his book, Imagining the Catholic Church. That's the title, Imagining the Catholic Church. And what he's doing is he's trying to anticipate what will the church of the third millennium look like, because it must continue to move and adapt and change. That's one thing studying the history of the church will teach you for sure, is that the church changes. And any thought that this or that thing has to be the way it always was, well, usually the always was goes back to about 1850. And that kind of frozen traditionalism is not faithful to the church at all. It's not faithful to the dynamism of spirit. So Lafont is trying to imagine, and he's offering some suggestions and some thoughts. He wrote this book around 2000, so he could not have seen Pope Francis coming. What he knew was Vatican II. And he knew that there was something prophetic unleashed at Vatican II that scares the hell out of a lot of people. And, you know, we want to be careful driving a bulldozer through people's fears. Try to respect those while not being bound by them. And he couldn't have imagined Pope Francis, I don't think. I certainly couldn't. Except we have hints of God, real hints of the real God, we know that God is a God of surprises. Who saw Pope Benedict resigning? Pretty amazing, actually. I'm thinking back to that day. I was awakened by a phone call from one of my nieces. It was actually a text message, but it woke me up. And it said, so who do you think the next pope will be? And I thought, oh God, did Benedict die? So I go on my computer. I start looking for what he resigned. And I remember feeling this jolt of energy, thinking, something's happening. Something's happening in this old church. I had the privilege, actually, Sister Julia and I met with this great theologian who she was very close friends with, a German theologian by the name of Johann Baptist Metz. And we spent some time chatting with him in August of 2012. Actually, in one of our little sidebar conversations, we got off on the American presidential race of that year, Obama versus Romney. And Father Metz was trying to understand how anybody could think that there was, you know, how could you possibly vote for that other man? he just thought, Romney is just like, oh my God, really serious? Anyway, so I pointed out to him that there were American bishops who were saying to their people, if you vote for a candidate that supports abortion, you cannot go to communion. And so Father Metz said to me, no, they're not saying that. And I said, Baptist, yes, they are. And it was a most interesting moment. I remember him kind of looking down for a minute and then saying, okay, he says, Kevin, I don't know your American bishops. Who am I to? I really don't know much about them. But I do know some of our bishops here in Europe. I know the bishops in Germany pretty well. And he said, and some of them I really, really feel sorry for because they don't believe in God. They believe in the church. And they believe in what they think about God. And they believe in their own office and their own authority, but they haven't met God. That really took me aback. I was really, really struck in that conversation by how, look, it can happen to any of us that we end up thinking that our own ideas, our own images, our own pet way of doing things, that that's the thing itself. It takes tremendous humility to really live a life of faith, because we're living in the presence of God, of that power of transcendence that is the source of everything, of all beauty. And so without that humility, we start, and this is the thing, our minds are amazing, our imaginations and our life stories. They're all, everyone in this room and all that we know, amazing beauty in each of our lives. But it's not the thing itself. It reflects the deeper beauty. You know, that sense of being suspended. I almost grasped God's. Thank God I couldn't. Because if I grasped it, it wouldn't have been God. It would have been an idol. If only I could learn to retain free fall and float into creator spirits, all embracing love. We don't earn it. It's grace. And it's all around us. It's everywhere. And the artist teaches us how to see. And the poet gives us words. Swaying bridges, she calls them. You know, quick, get across. It's the best we can do to try to put our experience of transcendence into language, in order to share it, in order to celebrate it together, in order to create communities around that sense of the divine. What a great vocation it is to live our lives into God. This journey that each of our lives is. And I find myself just super grateful for people like Pope Francis, who I see as like a prophet of this third millennial church. He's opening the door to a third millennial church. He's finding a lot of dead ends, a lot of buffeting, and a lot of rejection. There are fellow Catholics who despise him and who would like to see him dead. We need to pray for them. We need to love them. We need to find a way to recognize that their fear is rooted in their pain and not be imprisoned by that, but continue to breathe into the future, to imagine the Catholic Church of the next millennium. Our young people get it. They're not going to church in droves. It's kind of a contradiction to the image, but they really are voting with their feet because they can't take the hypocrisy and the disconnect. But here's the problem. You can't just invent a tradition all on your own. Even a great poet like Levertov is building on the shoulders of a much deeper, much older tradition, a beauty ever ancient, ever known. So we have an obligation to find ways to make the church new so that young people don't have to leave. I don't know how we do that. It's like the environment. I have some inklings of where to begin. But this is our work. This is the work I feel like of my generation, to try to continue to help the church do this epochal turn that it's trying to do. It's a massive shift that's occurring, and it's painful, and people don't understand, and the hinges are grinding. You can hear the squeal, but God's in this. God is in this. God is leading us, and I just thank God. So I just said for Pope Francis, I thank God for Denise Levertov. She's like one of the great teachers of my soul. She's really showed me a whole new image of faith that doesn't start with external adherence, but actually starts as a journey. And it has as its central compass, centering integrity, not gonna settle for false answers. And she wrote herself back into faith because she was as honest with her intimations of beauty, ever ancient, ever new, as she was with her doubts. She was not only honest with her doubts, she was honest with her faith. It never died. It led her in a great life of 74 years to become what I believe is one of the great poets in our language, in our age. So thanks very much. This looks like water, but it's not.
Yeah.
It changed into wine.
Thank you so very much, Kevin. I just don't know if there's any comment, question, if there's something you would like to, yeah, sure.